Okay, so at least for the first part of my talk, I could have used the last sentence of Terry's discussion as the title. That is, I'm going to talk about a phenomenological model for a combinatorial control of gene expression. And in a way, it's like the simplest, it's like a linear expansion of this more generalized nonlinear logic of inputs, where you just consider expression to be the additive effect of, at least in a log space, of multiple inputs of a gene. So this is this reduce algorithm that has come up a couple of times, and I will try to keep it a little bit short, just run you through it, just for completeness sake, and then discuss both a couple of applications to binding data for Drosophila and also for yeast. And one of the aspects I'm interested in is chromatin structure as a modulator of gene expression. And in a way, I'm trying to do that both from a bottom-up and a top-down, using a bottom-up and a top-down approach, and I will discuss both cases. Okay, so just a snapshot of all the machinery to make clear the fact that what I'd like to do is, based on all the molecular mechanisms that are present in the cell, you know, transcriptional activation, initiation, mRNA turnover, the recruitment of mRNA to polyribosomes, so translation initiation, and also the turnover of proteins. All these are molecular processes for which you could try to write down simplified equations, and then by, in a way, fitting these models to the data you have genome-wide from microarrays or proteomics, you could infer the various parameters and also the activities of these different regulatory modules. Okay, so here is this linear model that that Hao also showed. And so one thing to realize, and so again, this is stands for the log of the mRNA concentrations for gene G in experiment T, say. This is the connectivity matrix, which in this case is just the motif count for motif M in the promoter of gene G, and this would be the activity of the regulatory module that corresponds to that motif. So you can think about it as the concentration of the active form of the transcription factor in the nucleus. Okay, and what is interesting that this ties together the level of DNA, mRNA, or RNA, mRNA, and protein, but not in the sense of the central dogma where the flow is from DNA to RNA and then to protein, but in this case the protein is upstream of the DNA, right? This is the mRNA. These motif counts represent the non-coding part of the genome, and this F is something at the protein level, right? It corresponds to protein degrees of freedom. And by fitting this model to the expression data that you have, and knowing the static, this is the dynamic thing that changes in response to changes in external condition. This is the static part. That's another input, if you like. That is the distribution, the wiring diagram of the cell. By using those two pieces of information, you can infer these protein degrees of freedom, these protein activities. So you could call this in silico proteomics, if you like, or like ex vitro, maybe Boris would call it. But I don't know. So right here, you can infer things about protein degrees of freedom just from by looking at the targets of this protein, and so looking at the mRNA concentration, because indirectly they will tell you something about the phosphorylation state and also the location and the concentration in some combined fashion of this protein. It's, well, the assumption, since we're doing just standard linear regression, the assumption that this is some Gaussian noise. And you can estimate it from the residuals after you do the fit, and then get estimates for the errors in the fit parameters. Again, just a little bit more about this model. In a way, this is a two-step model, where this one of the steps is hidden, because the first step is to explain, given the concentration of the proteins and the binding sites, what are the occupancies of the different sites, right? And then the second step is the recruitment of the holo enzyme. And somehow, that is what leads to this expression. So somehow implicitly I'm assuming that this recruitment rate of the holoenzyme is constant. So, and that's really the limiting step is the binding of the of these proteins to the to their binding sites in the promoter. And so in a way it would be more natural to use this model to explain binding data in terms of motifs, right? And then you have one step less. You can use exactly the same model to explain given the set of log ratios that come out of a chromatin IP experiment or out of a chromatin profiling experiment. It's another technology that I will explain and discuss some data. You know, you could try to explain why you get a certain occupancy or log ratio from this chip experiment given the sequence of the locus that you probe in the binding experiment. Okay, and then these parameters would also correspond to the to these protein concentrations. Okay, so you can view this model in two different ways. You can view it as a motif finder, where so the simplest possible model is that the expression of every gene is the same, right? A equals C. Of course, that's a trivial model. So now we're going to improve upon this by adding one motif to the model. So we have two parameters, one explaining the expression for the genes that don't have the motif, and the other, you know, estimating the expression of the genes that do have the motif. So when we fit this model, we get an R squared, quality of fit. And we can rank a large class of motifs now based on this figure of merit. And we'll take the best motif out of, and it's going to be, you know, tens of thousands or even a million motifs. And there's been an example where I collaborated with a group that had a known gapped binding site, which was two bases and then 17 and then another three bases. And I scanned the whole space of gapped motif with varying number of bases, all different combinations. And there were a million combinations. And this consensus site came out as the top scoring out of the million sites. So it, even though you searched its very large space, it's pretty robust, and most of the motifs are going to be totally in the noise, and maybe a couple of hundred at most will be significantly correlated with this expression. Okay, and then the forward selection amounts to, as Hao already mentioned, as to iterating. You put in the best motif in the first iteration, and then you look at the residuals to decide which would be the next best motif to add to the model. And the reason is why you want to do that rather than just putting all the motifs that are significantly correlated to the expression is that there's a redundancy between variants of the same motif, you know, is overlapping the same signal. Okay, so this would be the final model. And so this will give you motifs, but more importantly are it is those fit parameters, these inferred transcription factor concentrations or module activities that are really the interesting part of this fit. And so in Hao's case, Hao used more information like expression data for the mutant or flanking sequence to improve the, this prediction and the discrimination of that. But the essential ingredient that you can infer these hidden degrees of freedom of the cell, if you like, by doing this fit is the same even with this simple model based on the motifs. Okay, and then you do this one microarray experiment at a time. But then you can multiple time points, for instance, and plot these inferred activities as a function of time. This is an example of the alpha pheromone synchronized time course in yeast. And what you see, the decay in the amplitude of this signal corresponds to the desynchronization of the culture. And it's important to realize that the sign of this, this would be zero. The sign doesn't tell you per se whether the factor is an activator or a repressor. In this case, it's just the activity with respect to the reference sample, which would, in this case would be the asynchronous culture, you know, where you didn't synchronize the cells to be in the same phase of the cell cycle. Yes? Yeah, that's a good point. So in principle, if we have 10,000 motifs, I have 10 to the or 2 to the 10,000 different models, right? I could try all of those, calculate R squared, and then pick the best combination of motifs. So this and then forward selection would be to start with the best motifs and then add the next one. It's a heuristic way of, you know, assuming that there's no barriers or somehow lack of a path towards the best model. So it's not guaranteed that it's the best model, but it's a good practical way to go about. If your set of motifs is relatively limited, for instance, you would start from a set of known binding sites, and we're also doing this things. For example, the SCPD promoter element database curated by Michael Zheng has a bunch of consensus motifs for a couple of dozen factors. You can fit a model based on those known factors, and you know the associated transcription factor. And then, given some transcription factor or micro experiment, what you can do, you can fit this model to tell you which transcription factors, known transcription factors, changed activity between the red and the green condition that you probed. And this is very interesting information for biologists. And in fact, the next slide is exactly what I'm going to show, is that I was in a collaboration with people at the Academic Medical Institute in Amsterdam who did a time course experiment. I predicted that the MSN24, that is the stress response pathway, was activated in a certain metabolic time course experiment. And then what they did was to create a fusion. And so I apologize for the poor quality of this graph, but this is essentially the activity of MSN24, of the stress response element. It went down first with respect to the initial condition, and then back up again. And what they did was to monitor the fluorescent intensity for GFP to MSN2 fusion during the same time course. And what was seen is that initially there was fluorescent intensity in the nucleus of the cells, right? And then this would disappear into the cytoplasm, and later on come back into the nucleus, consistent with this time course. So this is experimental confirmation of a prediction by reduced, but not a new binding motif and finding a corresponding transcription factor, but just a very well-known consensus motif, but just an unexpected role for the associated transcription factor during this process.
Have we tried also to look at MSN4? Because there are some kind of redundancies between these two. Typically, people think they work together.
Right. In this case, it was just MSM24, and also they did something similar with YAB1, but MSM4, there was no GFP fusion. I forget whether there was some problem with the experiment or whether they just didn't do it. But it's definitely, I mean, in general, this question about this redundancy between factors is very interesting. Yes, Chris? So the z-score in this case is just this fit parameter f minus the mean divided by the standard deviation. It's like a t-value from the.
So none of those curves is the fluorescence of the
function of time. Sorry, can you repeat that?
None of those curves is the fluorescence of the function of time.
That would
be nice to compare directly.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. So this. Yeah. You could. Imagine that. By quantifying this, show a curve. You could even imagine calculating a Pearson correlation or something, although based on 4 time points it wouldn't be too reliable. But that's definitely an interesting thing to do in general. Okay, so just to show some ohm words and some boxes, this is like a schematic version of what's going on here. So the mechanistic model is this simplified description of this molecular process of transcriptional initiation. This is the NMG, say, in the model, that this is a set of these motif counts that are a representation of the non-coding part of the genome. So, or if you like, of the genome-wide set of upstream regions, the upstrom or 5' sequences, the 5'.
Is this prone special word?
I made this up, yeah. So this one is semi-serious. This, of course, is for your amusement. The transcriptome, that is these A's that are on the left-hand side, yeah, the dependent variable. And these are the independent variables, and these are the regression coefficients. Okay, now, so if you would know these transcription factor activities, and you know the wiring diagram of the cell, and you know how these calculations are performed at the promoters, then you could predict the mRNA concentration. Right? This is kind of forward use of this model. And so what we're doing now with this motif inference and this activity inference is to do a reverse engineering problem where we know the output, and we know one of the inputs, that is the static of the inputs. And we're trying to infer this dynamic input, this regulome. And so the regulome, what I mean with that is some concrete representation of the state of the cell, and more concrete, it's the set of transcription factor activities of the relevant fraction, that is the phosphorylated version in the nucleus, right? So this is what defines the state of the cell. And so, for instance, for in terms of physics type of assumptions, you could say we're assuming some kind of for these time courses, some adiabatic limit where the transcription pattern somehow is slaved by these regulatory degrees of freedom. Of course, when things change very quickly, because there's ultimately feedback into this, these regulators are encoded by some of these genes. It's in general not the case. Okay, and just to generalize it a little bit more is, of course, there's not only transcription factors that affect transcription initiation, there's also factors that have to do with regulation of mRNA turnover. Okay, and so there's two types of proteins that involve in the flux from DNA to mRNA. This is a word coined by Mark Gerstein, I think. The idea is that proteome is like a set of structures, and the translatome would be the set of ratios between the mRNA and the protein concentration, right? So if the protein concentrations can be different, but if they're proportional to the mRNA concentrations, then there's no regulation. So any structure in those ratios would correspond to regulation of mRNA to protein. And again, there is, this recruitment to polysomes and transport through the nuclear membrane, etc. Those are things that affect the rate of translation initiation, and then things having to do with the proteasome and specific degradation of proteins. There's other, in principle, other protein factors that can regulate that and that can change in activity. And in principle, you could infer all those using a similar type of approach. And then the final step to get to the genetic networks is to realize that these are just a subset of this proteome, of the set of proteins. So that will generate or give you the feedback, and it will generate the, in principle, closed set of equations that, if you would infer all these parameters, of course you will not be able to simulate it, but at least philosophically it's interesting to keep this structure in mind. Okay, this tool is, as of last week, finally is available online. It's also quoted in, for example, House, nice review in Methods in Enzymology, and a couple of other papers. So what you can do is you can go to this website, upload any number of transcriptomes, organize them into directory structure, create directories or move things around, and then submit them for reduced analysis using different sequences and different motif sets, etc. And then you can view the results, and hopefully in a couple of weeks, download these as a deptalinibit file, etc. Just one corollary of this whole approach is you can view this regression in a couple of different ways, and especially. So first of all, of course, you do a regression, but you could also say I take the vector of log ratios, mRNA log ratios, and a vector of motif counts, and I calculate the Pearson correlation between them. This is, it's not strictly cast in a regression. Of course, the reason why R squared is called R squared is that it's just the square of the Pearson correlation if you do a single motif fit. So that's one way of thinking about it. Then you can deconstruct this more, because if a motif would only occur once or zero times in a promoter, which is depending a bit on the what kind of factor it is, but it, for many cases, that's a reasonable assumption. And moreover, if the number of target genes then is small compared to the genome, what you're really scoring with this Pearson correlation is the difference between the average expression of the genes that have the motif in their promoter and the genome-wide average in units of the standard deviation of the genome-wide distribution, right? And I should have made a slide for this. This is the genome-wide distribution, and Howe had a similar graph. If you now look at the average expression of the genes that have the motif, depending on where it lies on this curve, it's either you would call this motif a significant positive regulator or a significant negative regulator. What is interesting about this is that suppose you hit 100 genes with the motif, that the average of these 100 genes is going to be distributed with a standard deviation, that's the genome-wide single gene standard deviation, divided by the square root of 100. So the variance of this average in the null hypothesis, it's much smaller. So given the same, so if a single gene has a 1.4-fold induction, this is not significant at all, it will drown in the noise. But if 100 genes have an average induction of 1.4-fold, suddenly this will be highly significant because the reference distribution has shrunk due to the, so you can by looking at these modes in a way, you can be much more sensitive and you can pick up small amplitude coordinate changes in pathways much more sensitively than by, for instance, first doing clustering based on some threshold for individual gene induction or repression, and then doing hypergeometric scoring overlap with other categories, for instance. And so I've in fact implemented this idea already some time ago, and so it's available, or I will link this to the same website, it's now some separate thing for collaborators, but where you take geo categories or MIPS categories, functional categories, you calculate the average expression in that category and calculate the z-score, or measuring the difference from the genome-wide mean in units of the standard deviation. And it turns out that this is a very convenient way of quantifying this ontology, these functional categories. So hence the, depending on the day, annoying or cute acronym, quantology, that's what I call this, quantified ontology. Okay, and there's also negative categories, but most of the categories will be, somewhere around zero, there will be noise. And let's see, so what is interesting about it is somehow, if you think about the hierarchy of these ontologies, that is, there are high-level categories that have many genes, then there are lower-level categories that have less genes, and then, again, children of those, somehow this will automatically pick the right level in this hierarchy. If you go up, you'll mix in more genes. If those are not regulated, you'll degrade the signal. If you go down, you get more specific, you'll miss some of the induced genes, and you'll also, this more fine-grained category will score less well. And it's totally analogous to the motif length in the, for the motif fitted. If you make the motif shorter, it corresponds to going up in a hierarchy, you include more genes. If you make the motif longer, you would go down in this hierarchy, you have more specific geo categories. And in the same way that the right level is picked in the geo, the motif length is also, in principle, can be selected kind of naturally by without any specifying any external parameters. Although in practice, we limit the size of the motifs for yeast to 7 just because of the outlier problem. If motifs get 8 or 9, you can hit a single gene with such a motif. It doesn't match anywhere else, and then you'll fit this one outlier. And just you could also, probably it's better to get rid of the outliers and then just have no limit on the length. But that's what we do in practice. Okay, so now I'll shift gears a little bit and discuss an alternative to chromatin IP. This is Bas van Steensel. He's at the Netherlands Cancer Institute. And when he was a postdoc with Steve Hanikoff at Hutchinson in Seattle, he developed a way of doing genome-wide location profiling for proteins. And this is published for Drosophila last year, or 2 years ago even, in Nature Genetics. And now he's trying to get it to work for human. But what is shown in this schematic diagram, and it follows very similar, the chromatin IP protocol, but there are a couple of important differences. The idea is to make a fusion protein of a DNA binding domain that you're interested in, of a transcription factor, and a methyl transferase that will methylate A's in the genome. And A is not methylated in vivo, it's not used by Drosophila. So it's a perfect marker that you can use. It's somehow orthogonal to the whole machinery of the cell. What is also nice is that the way he does this is by transfecting the cell with a plasmid that has a low level promoter. So the fusion protein is just a small fraction of the wild type protein, but whenever it's this protein is exchanged and this fusion version of it happens to bind there, this fused methylase domain will methylate these A's in the genome. And you incubate the cells overnight, say 24 hours, and the methylation it is stable. So once you mark this site, it will stay there and it will just accumulate. Okay, and then then you harvest these cells in some way I don't know too much about. And there's an important step that you now come in with a restriction enzyme and cut specifically these methylated A's in the context of GATC. Right? So what this will do is, because these GATCs, these potential methylated cleavage sites, occur every 100 base pairs or so, if this locus is methylated, you will generate small fragments from this locus. And then you run some sucrose gradient, some kind of gradient, and get out this length fraction. And the important thing is to choose a reference now. So this shows in blue the DNA binding domain, and in yellow this methylase. It's the other way around, sorry. Blue is the methylase domain, yellow is the DNA binding domain. And so it's important to realize that in Drosophila there's open chromatin regions and there's closed chromatin regions. So there will be, even for the methylase only, there will be certain loci that are methylated at a higher level just because they're more accessible. And so in the microarray they would have a higher intensity for a red. But if you use this as a reference and then compare that with where the case where you can have additional methylation due to this DNA binding domain, then the log ratios you read out from this cDNA microarray will tell you something about the occupancy. Okay, so that's in fact that's something we looked at systematically. It's on the order of KB, 2 KB around the site, and this is both the blessing and a curse. And in fact, we're exploiting exactly this low resolution to get something interesting about context dependence, right? Because so, and that's a very important difference with the chromatin IP, because with the chromatin IP, you only get as target in the Nature Genetics supplement sense, the stuff that you put on the microarray. The fragments that were directly bound in this cross-linked complex with the protein. So you need intergenic probes on the microarray, otherwise you wouldn't pick up anything. In this case, so this is just a histogram of these log ratios, right? So you see it's asymmetric because the bound loci will have a significantly larger log ratio, and there's no negative cases. So this shows schematically the situation. This is a typical gene, so there's a couple of exons, introns, and intergenic regions. And the probe on the microarray is a cDNA, so it's most of the coding region here. So from one point of view, if a vector binds somewhere in this region, and this is not the transcription factor per se, it doesn't bind to the promoter, it's a more general DNA binding protein that's associated with a variety of functions like acetylation, deacetylation, and other things. So if a protein binds somewhere, as Terry asked, the methylation will be a couple of KB left and right of this binding site. So if you now look at the methylation at a particular position, this could have resulted from binding anywhere, again, in a 2 KB region around this around this probe, right? And so the signal you get from the microarray will be some kind of superposition of contributions from binding to exons, introns, and intergenic region that somehow together, define this methylation degree of this probe. And so what we did was we varied the size of this region and used the t value corresponding to the regression coefficient. Now, doing this, reduce to explain these binding log ratios in terms of motifs counts in these loci, right? And then you can use r squared for the best motif. And it turns out that the consensus motif is a GAGAG motif. In general, it's repeats of GA of this dimer. Of length 4 through 6 or 7 that are the binding site. So it turns out that around 2 KB there's an optimal choice. And so this is just the output of reduce ran on this one set of binding log ratios. And what you get is essentially the forward and the reverse complement version of this consensus binding site, this GA repeat that was already known. Okay, so there's no real surprise there. But what was a surprise to us was that when we and we didn't set out doing this, but we found some kind of length dependence for somehow that the length of the region correlated with expression, and we looked in more detail. And then we found out that if you take this one consensus motif, this GAGAG, okay, and you correlate it with this binding log ratio. And now you split out the occurrences of this binding site in terms of whether they occur in exon, intron, or intergenic sequence. And you have separate fit coefficients for each. So each coefficient would represent the contribution to the binding to that locus as a whole, as measured using this one spot on the microarray, by exon or intergenic or intron sequence. We found that essentially intergenic and introns all contributed positively to binding, but exons didn't contribute at all. So it was a striking, even though the density at which these sites occur, genome-wide, per 10 kb or whatever unit in these different types of sequence, where there was no similar structure. If there would have been no binding sites, some avoidance, maybe because of codon composition or whatever, avoidance of this site in exons, then it would be easy to explain. But there was nothing like that going on. So we scratched our head for a while. We thought about what could explain this. And there was a couple of candidate explanations. One, but two of which involved that there were some proteins that specifically bind either to exons or a non-exon sequence. You could imagine that there's something that binds to exons for whatever reason that prevents this Gaga factor from binding. Right? It's hard to imagine. Then you've deferred the problem to something else. Why does this bind to exons? You could also imagine there's something that somehow creates cooperativity, generates cooperativity in intron or intergenic sequence, some other factor. In fact, it turns out that somehow this Gaga factor, that cooperativity at least partially explains this phenomenon, because when we looked at the spatial distribution of these sites, so we took this length 5 consensus motif and then counted how many simultaneous occurrences of these two we have with one base in between, or 0, 1, 2, 3 bases in between, we found that that there's a striking difference first between what is shown in this graph, the most bound, the highest scoring loci. And this is then as a control, like a random subset of the non-bound loci. But there was a clear preference for having two of those Gaga sites closely spaced to each other. And you see an even odd oscillation because somehow you have to be in frame of this GA repeat. And then when we looked at the contribution to this clustering from exons, introns, and intergenic, we found that all this clustering was caused by these sites occurring in introns and intergenic region and not in exons. So it's somehow, exons don't have this clustering of these two sites, and they're probably, they therefore lack cooperative binding of two of those same proteins at nearby locations. And that at least partially explains this result. Okay, now another thing that that was done, this was done in a collaboration with Bob Eisenman at the Hutchinson and Bas van Steensel and also Jeff Delroe, who runs the microwave facility there, and a couple of other people. So this is a paper, is in press. Essentially, all I did was run and redo some of their binding data. But we had some interesting results. So this is it's essentially the same diagram that was shown before of MYC as a heterodimer with NACS binds to the E-box. And this is Introsoftware. Right, and MYC recruits an acyl transferase complex, this trap that will acetylate the tails of the histones and activate this region. And in MAX, together with MAD, can recruit a deacetylase and lead to repression of this region by deacetylating the tails of the histones. Okay, so there were four different binding experiments performed, or at least, so this uses this fusion protein of a DNA binding domain with this methyl transferase. So that was what, and this is an in vivo measurement of binding affinity, right? Because this is this fusion protein in some low relative concentration is part of the whole machinery with all the other proteins, right? So Well, we found that Mint, which is a Drosophila homolog of NAD, which is this regression complex, it had a clear association, first of all, with the e-box and a couple of variants, which was nice to see, but in fact, as significant, or maybe more significant even, were two other motifs. One motif, TATCGATA, it's a palindrome, and that's known as the DRE element. So it was a known element. In fact, correlates strongly with min binding, but also with max, if you label max with this methyl transferase, or with MYC. Interestingly, a MYC, you know, if this binding assay was performed with MYC in the presence of max and in the absence of max, there was a marked difference. Right? And this somehow proves that you need max for MYC to bind to the DNA. If you don't have this heterodimeric partner, you will not have binding.
So what do you mean by low max? So what cell did you use? What did you use to do the experiment?
Drosophila cells. I think it was a cell line. I think it was a KC cell line. But
so in those cells, you're putting both max and MYC, or just putting the MYC?
Right. So this was when max was present at the highest physiological concentration, I think.
Both were transfected into the cell, reintroduced into the cell.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So these were really different strains. It was not just this plasmid with the fusion protein, but it was something else was done to change the expression of max. But MINT does bind, this was only done for MYC, so probing the binding of MYC and then changing the concentration of max. So probably max was present here in MINT. There was also a motif out here, GTCACAC, that is not known, that also correlated with this binding.
When you run this reduced protein, what promoter region you pick?
So we use this the same plus or minus 2 kb around the cDNA sequence.
Plus minus 2 kb around the cDNA stuff with the
transcription. Yeah, so the beginning of the first exon, the end of the last exon, including the introns, and then 2 kb to the left and the right.
So the p-value for cDNA is 0, is that right?
So it's so small that it's smaller than 10 to the minus 16, essentially. Well, so yeah, but there's still specific CGC repeats or CG repeats. So I mean, we don't know really what to make of this, and it could be some kind of artifact. So these repetitive sequences or these single A's or T's that somehow measure the AT content of those loci. You know, it's harder to justify that those are bona fide reticents. But you know,
how many genes were identified?
There were surprisingly many, like hundreds. Okay, so now I'm going back to the more humble organism of yeast and some things this is unpublished data done with a postdoc in my lab. So so far I've discussed two types of regression analysis. The one is explain expression patterns in terms of motif content of the promoter, right? Since reduced. The thing I just talked about is explain binding log ratios in terms of motifs in the promoter or the locus in general. So now there's a third way of combining these three letters is to explain expression in terms of binding, right? And that's really, you know, if you know what the occupancies are, can I predict the expression? And in a way, coming back to this original motivation for this reduced model, there's this two-step process. The first is like a recognition process where you know which proteins bind where. The second step has more to do with regulatory logic. What is the nature of the computation that's performed at the promoter? Well, given the inputs now in terms of occupancies, what is the expression level that results from that? And so that has to do with you know how the whole enzyme is recruited, etc. So there's no motifs now anymore. There's just the binding data from the Li et al. Paper, and there's expression data from Spellman et al. In this case. And so we also were motivated by our suspicion that there may be many false positives among these chromatin P targets if you have a criterion purely based on the on this binding log ratio. Right? So what this shows is a curve very similar to what I showed before. It's the same expression data, but now these are fit coefficients obtained from this model explaining binding expression in terms of binding. Right? So it's an inferred transcription factor activity, but now it's inferred by looking at the targets that are predicted by chromatin P and somehow weighted using the strength of the binding rather than just motif counts. Yeah? No, this is it's pure. It's just the log ratios from the.
Your coefficient in the original version of the U seems to be the number of modules.
Right.
And now the chip data says yes, no, or some funny P value. Right. Do you?
I only use the log ratio. The original log ratio from the young data.
Oh. Okay.
So there's no threshold involved, or this is just for each gene the log ratio from the microarray. Including all the noise, etc. And so, in fact, the noise.
So you're just computing the correlation between log ratio of young data and the.
Right.
And the cell cycle.
Yeah.
Just computing pure correlation.
Right. That's it. And so there's a trade-off between two effects. On the one hand, the young data is a real in vivo measurement. I mean, modulo experimental complications of the real binding. Right. So you expect the fit to the binding data to be better than for the motifs. Because many of the motifs are pseudos occurring, they're not really functional, and how used the mutant for the corresponding transcription factor to somehow weed out the pseudo sites from all the set of all sites that match this consensus motif. So the other thing, let's see. On the other hand, there's noise in the binding data. Right, so if you try to explain expression data by doing regression on a factor of numbers drawn from a normal distribution, you're not going to get anything very significant. So it's really expression explained in terms of binding plus noise. And so it really depends on the numerical ratio between. You know, on the one hand, there's a potential for improvement because you're more systematic, you're measuring the real occupancy. On the other hand, there's a noise component that's going to degrade your fit. It turns out, in fact, that the quality of fit, the R squared, using binding data is an order of magnitude worse, smaller R squared than with the motifs. So somehow the noise is large. And of course we heard in several different guises that this data is pretty noisy. But this is still useful and still it's very significant. The R squared is the p-value corresponding to that is very significant. Okay, so now we did one more thing because this now is an inferred activity for this transcription factor. So now we did something very similar, what was also discussed earlier, correlating this inferred activity with an individual gene's mRNA expression profile. So now the idea is that if this gene is bound, or it could also be in terms of motifs, if the gene has a motif, or in this case, if it's bound by the, predicted to be bound by the young data, is it regulated by the factor? And so if you correlate this inferred activity profile with the mRNA concentration of the gene, if you find a correlation, at least they've had a component in the direction of this thing in the experiment space, then it's a real functional target. If there's no component, it will not be regulated. Right? So it's a way, it's a generalization of what Hao talked about of using an actual experiment of the deletion and look whether you have a change in expression if you knock out the transcription factor. Now you don't do explicitly this deletion, but you exploit the fact that if you have a rich enough set of experiments that contains cases where this factor is highly active and it is lower, you have a means of getting some kind of contrast between those sets. So without having the explicit knockout experiment, you can still make these predictions. And so what's shown here is, and so this Pearson correlation now between this activity profile and a mRNA profile for a given gene, you can again calculate Pearson correlation or some other non-parametric correlation, and we call that the coupling parameter. It was the same thing as this connectivity matrix between a gene and a regulator. And then in this direction, we just plot the Li et al. Log ratio, and we put a threshold both on the log ratio. So this chromatin IP above some threshold would predict that these are the bound genes, right, that are regulated by that factor. But we also drew a threshold in this coupling direction. And so we have four sets of genes. We have junk here. We have junk of a different type, as will soon become clear. And then here are genes that are regulated, but not directly bound by SY4. Or maybe there are also, you could include false negatives in the sense of, you know, the binding log ratio. But there's also, since this is cell cycle, there's of course different factors that peak around G1 that would also correlate with this. So,
sorry,
how
might be the y-axis? What
is
y-axis?
So y-axis is the correlation between this F profile, this inferred.
But F profile, so here each point is a gene, right?
Each point is a gene, yeah.
So
I did this regression for between the expression value and the log ratio for every time point in the Spellman set.
So the expression value and the young data.
Right, so I get a module activity, inferred module activity for each time point.
Okay.
For SY4. And then I plot that as a function of time in these experiments.
For each gene.
Well, that's a global thing, right? This inferred activity is.
No,
but that's one ingredient. And then the other ingredient is that I have this global activity pattern and I correlate that with each individual gene.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so this will
correlate the AF for the fitting correlation with the gene.
With the mRNA. Yeah.
Exactly. See how tight is that.
Exactly. So this just tells you whether this gene varies with the inferred activity of the factor. Okay? And now and so this is the set, the most interesting, that this stuff is bound but also coupled. Right, this is bound but not coupled, and this is coupled but not bound. So now we use the simple hypergeometric function to score overlap with MIPS categories to see whether these different sets of genes what they look like.
You never get somebody in this negative whatever binding region, the upper left corner.
Right, and so that you could say here, and that's another reflection of that this contains more, these are real targets and these perhaps are not, because here it's symmetric, you know, if there's no coupling you also have negative outliers, you know, above minus the same absolute threshold as on the positive side.
When you try to do something very similar in processor data, sometimes things show up in the upper left corner too, so that must really say something about the quality of the chip data.
I guess so, yeah, because our main problem is that sometimes we don't have anything here, but we haven't seen. And here there's a clear asymmetry. So here, there you don't see the negative mirror image of this cloud of points. And so we took all the MIPS categories and took the red genes, for instance, and scored the overlap using this hypergeometric distribution, did some multiple hypothesis, Wolf-Rooney correction to have a fair p-value. And then just look what we had for these three different color categories. And for the red category, which is the one, are the real targets, we find a lot of categories like cell differentiation, budding, chromosome structure that indicative of cell cycle regulation. The blue category, which is stuff that behaves similarly but is not explicitly bound, contains a lot of G1 stuff in general. This is not so interesting because there's not so much variation. There's not a very large set of experiments. But very strikingly, the green set, which is the one that was bound but not coupled, so these ones, let's say the young false positives, we found no significant overlap with any of the MIPS categories for this set, whereas we find a couple of different categories where there was overlap. So this is, we consider reasonably strong evidence that this is a very useful way to impose a second criterion on these genes to say whether they're targets of this transcription factor, yes or no. Okay, so and now now you could take these coupling parameters, and now you could somehow say, well, now I have an improved set of targets of this gene. I'm now going to use that to recalculate this activity profile and somehow iterate. And this is how we very naturally came to this exactly the same equations that that came up earlier. Although we don't keep these all coupling constants. David kept the coupling constants zero for the ones that were initially zero. And that's probably why we got this instability in the iteration that he didn't get. Anyway. Okay, so still we don't know what distinguishes the upper right corner from the straight to the right. It could be that they're the non-coupling promoters, so the ones that are not high up, they are real false positives. It could also be that they are truly bound by the transcription factor, and that in a way the chip assay is okay, but they're somehow failed to recruit the polymerase complex. It's hard to say. And then maybe they have another role, and they could just be there to, for instance, contribute to cooperative binding with another factor that does recruit. But you know, there's many different scenarios, I guess. Okay, so just a quick, I'll just quickly show some pictures related to another project, which is entirely different, which is a collaboration with the group at the, in Amsterdam, again at the medical school. What they did some time ago, and they published in Science last year, in the genome issue, 2 years ago by now, was they mapped SAGE data for human on the radiation hybrid map of the human chromosomes. So SAGE is a way of extracting tags from in kind of a select, more or less unbiased manner from mRNAs using a polyethyl and some recognition site. So, and then these are 10 base pairs long, and you just concatenate them somehow, and then you sequence them. And if you sequence enough of those tags, you get counts that are proportional to the mRNA abundance in the cell. And so that was, it's a good measure of absolute expression. And when they met that to spatially to the chromosome, they found very pronounced domains of high expression clustering and also low expression. So somehow, if your null hypothesis would be that these genes, that it doesn't matter if you take any permutation of the gene order on all the chromosomes, you know, they're not really spatially connected. This turned out not to be correct. And in fact, now we started to collaborate and got a grant together from the Dutch government. And so the idea is to combine, to now explain these structures, first do more solid statistics on whether they're there or not, and then try to explain, see if we can explain those structures in terms of the underlying sequence, because ultimately there has to be something in the genome, but it may be hard to make explicitly the connection with the sequence content that creates those structures. Okay, so this just shows for chromosome number 3 and number 9 the median expression in a moving window along the chromosome. And we take the median because if you look on a very small scale, you know, individual genes can be off or on. So it's not really, it's more like a domain structure. It hasn't, it's not directly the individual genes. And so the median is a better way of getting rid of this noise. And so now if you would compare this profile to what you get if you take a random permutation of all these genes and then run the same moving median, you see whether the peaks you get are higher than you would expect, you know, in this ensemble. So we did a lot of sampling over hundreds of thousands or so random permutations, and calculated p-values and used that to determine which positions in the genome for a given window size, you know, the expression was significantly higher or significantly lower than you would expect, even as an extreme, the highest value in the whole genome for a random permutation, right? So if we, you could say, we generate a random permutation of the order of all genes, we move a window through the whole genome, and then record the highest value over the maximum over the whole genome. If we find a value somewhere, if we find a value anywhere in the real genome above this threshold, we color it red. And otherwise we color it blue. Right? And so you could say these are hot regions in the genome. And so I have to explain the axis here to see whether they're triangles. This is the position on the genome measured in just how many unigene clusters you're away from the left end. Right? And then the window size is represented in the vertical direction. And to explain why it's in the triangle, you could say at the top, that means the window has the size of the chromosome. So there's only one, the middle position is only one possibility, it's in the center of the chromosome. As the window gets smaller, there are more and more positions, and window size one can fit anywhere. And that's the base of the triangle. Right? And then we score this median expression in this window. And the nice thing about this representation is that you don't have to select a length scale a priori. You can just look at all these different length scales simultaneously. Right, and you see, for instance, if the top of the triangle has a color, either blue or red, it means that the expression of the genes, the median expression of the genes in the chromosome is significantly different from a random sample of the genome. So these are globally higher than average or lower than average expressed chromosomes. But you see there's a lot of structure here. There are certain domains and sometimes really well-defined length scales and positions for these expression clusters. Okay. Now, we went on to do this. There's a couple of, these are dynamic quantities. That is expression, no? it's variable. And we want to explain these structures in terms of the static properties of the genome. So there's a couple of simple things you can look at. This GC concentration, right? That is, you know, just the GC content in different windows on the chromosome, or inverse intron length or gene density. It turns out that these quantities also have the same clustering by themselves. Okay? But that still doesn't explain, it's not a correlation between the SAGE count and these static quantities. So we also looked at, basically in the rank space, look at correlation between these quantities and, you know, do some kind of non-parametric correlation between SAGE count on the one hand and GC content or gene density on the other. And there's also, you can use Kolmogorov-Smirnov test to test whether the set of genes that are, you know, in these high expression regions, whether they are enriched for high GC content genes, for instance, et cetera. Anyway, we did a couple of different tests to establish that there is, in fact, a correlation between these you know, general genomic features and these expression domains, but still, we don't have no idea really about the mechanism. Of course, it could have just be domains of chromatin, like euchromatic and heterochromatic domains. Maybe they play a role, and maybe these boundary elements or polychrome group proteins that.
Another thing is that probably methylation, because learned that CGI are associated with methylation.
Right. So yeah, so it's another.
High GC region, less methylation.
Right. Yeah. So there's, and we're in fact now working on kind of cataloging all these different types of information and see if we can correlate this with this expression pattern. And so you could say there, you could have two hypotheses. One, you could say, see, it's imaginable that evolution has just chosen to put highly expressed genes close together because there's some cooperativity mediated just by the chromatin, but there the chromatin would play a passive role. You know, it would, very similar to Terry's single histone version of cooperativity mediated by between two transcription factors, you could have a somewhat larger scale have a similar effect. But you could also have an active role of chromatin where really specific boundary elements and polychrome response elements and things like that, you know, modulate domains of the chromosome. And so this is kind of the top-down approach where we're starting with these big domains and we're trying to see if we can somehow explain why they're there and get more specific. And the other thing I talked about in Drosophila, this Gaga factor, and we're in fact doing this profiling with other chromatin-associated proteins is a way of looking at a single protein in the context of the chromatin, all the other proteins, and see if we somehow can understand chromatin structure from the bottom up. But that's more on a single gene level, I think, you know, regulation in terms of acetylation, deacetylation. Whereas these are really multi-gene domains. Okay? So it's, Eric talked about this in his talk a little bit. So it's a protein that if somewhere it nucleates somewhere on the chromosome, and then it will polymerize, and it will, many polychromes will bind to the spread out to both directions, I think, or maybe one direction, and silence the chromatin. But then if you have a boundary element, it will not spread further than that boundary element. So it's a way of establishing and limiting domains of silence chromatin. Okay, so of course the reduce originally was developed with Eric and Howe, and also Boris. We had a very good discussion with him a couple of times. These are the people in Amsterdam who did the GFP fusion for this oleate response time course. These are the people in Amsterdam that collaborates for this human transcriptome map. Bas van Steensel already mentioned. Jeff Delro, who runs the microwave facility at Hutchinson, and this is the postdoc, and Bob Eisenman is the senior person for the MIC collaboration, and two funders. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I just want to press for one question in your MIC part. Because from my study, I didn't see an abundant representation of V-box in the set of promoters that I pull out.
Mm-hmm.
But you tend to pull out the V-box at a very low p-value. So can you translate that into a number, for example, how many promoters you pull out and how many have V-box?
Right. So the reason why it's picked up this way and not the other way is maybe exactly what I said about this threshold business, that if you look at, you define the threshold for binding and then say these genes are bound by this factor, by MYC, and these genes are not. And then you score the overlap between that set of targets above threshold and, you know, the set of genes that have this motif or some functional category. You may miss signal that is small amplitude but kind of involves a lot of genes. So what we do is we look at the average binding log ratio of all the genes that have a e-box in the locus, somehow weighted, log ratio weighted by the e-box, number of e-boxes. And this is much more sensitive.
Yeah, but you still haven't answered my question.
Yeah, but whether we looked at the overrepresentation of whether in Drosophila there is an overlap.
Well, clearly there is an overrepresentation. I just want to have a feeling of how much overrepresentation the sets of genes that were qualified as main targets in this study. Because that's the only thing that I can compare to.
Right. So I didn't do that explicitly because if you would get something like that, you would also come out of this regression analysis. It's only in a case where you have this small amplitude broad set that you may only pick it up with this more sensitive approach. But it would be interesting. So were you saying in human you don't find a significant overlap between the targets and the
e-box? I did not
e-box.
Find overrepresentation of MYC, the e-box. In the set of genes that I pull out
right.
by IP, and I have been puzzled by that. Right. But looking at, I just want to figure out in whether that's a just unique situation for the type of system that I use.
Right. So if you have a file, if you have a file with log ratios from your chip experiment, if you also have a file with the number of e-boxes in each locus,
mm-hmm.
which then you can just do a regression analysis or a Pearson correlation between those two factors,
mm-hmm.
and see if that would be totally equivalent to what I did. So it would be interesting to try, I think.
Okay, let's come again.
Okay.